This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
...of one for a long time, holding a cigarette with Marisol's phone number. She'd just call her and say hi, even though it was late. She had no idea what time it was, but she knew it had to be at least 3 a.m. She dialed the number and hung up when she realized she didn't have any change. She considered breaking another 100 and getting some rolls of quarters from the change girl, but she felt impatient. She dialed the operator and asked to place a collect call. While the operator dialed, Theo's heart pounded. She wanted to hear Marisol's voice. She regretted having come to Atlantic City.
This is Jennifer Kemp for Between the Covers, and today I'm speaking with Allie Liebgott, the author of Cha-Ching. Hi, Allie. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
So what is the premise of Cha-Ching? Who is Theo, and what are the main things that happened to her during the novel?
Theo is an almost 30 queer person who's decided to move to New York to kind of completely overhaul her life. And she's got a few addictions. She's battling some gambling addiction and some alcohol addiction. And so she goes to New York and tries to change her life. But maybe it didn't change exactly how she thought it might.
And she picks up a dog along the way, right?
The morning she's leaving San Francisco, she sees a dog get thrown off a roof. And she rushes it to the hospital and then inadvertently adopts it. It's a pit bull named Cary Grant.
Why is his name Cary Grant?
Because it has a scar across the top of its head that looks like one of those old dapper hair parts. So she went with Cary Grant.
So you sort of mentioned this when you were introducing Theo as a character, but Theo battles a couple different addictions. Talk about those and talk about how that plays out in the novel.
Well, when I'm very interested in addiction, and so when I started writing the novel, I thought it would be really great to write a novel about someone who, like, battled one addiction and succeeded and then ended up having a secondary addiction. And then that's not exactly what happened with the novel, but that was my original impulse when writing it. She had a drinking problem, and she also wanted to quit smoking cigarettes. She's like turning 30, so she wants to kind of, like, I'm going to start exercising and read books and quit doing these like 20-year-old things, you know, and not getting into like weird bar accidents, you know. And then as she's traveling across country, one of the motels she stays in is linked to a casino, and she doesn't have a lot of money, so she's sort of caught in that trap of thinking, like, I'll just win the money I need. And so she's sort of triggered by that. And then when she does have a couple wins, she starts to think, like, oh, I can somehow control this winning. I'm going to use positive thinking to win more. And maybe not so much.
Because she also has a gambling addiction, right?
Yes. No, she has a terrible gambling addiction. In fact, I think in the book, which I haven't been reading from the gambling parts that much on tour, actually, but I think in the book it refers to her gambling addiction actually scares her more than her alcohol addiction ever did. So it's – but that goes back to the original concept of, like, the concept of an addictive personality, and maybe the substance doesn't matter. You know what I mean? That is just sort of like – that was my original impulse when I was writing the book, was like to just sort of go with that concept of it didn't matter what the substance was at some point. It was just that impulse to be like checked out.
So you think that Theo just basically has an addictive personality?
Yeah, well, yeah, she definitely does. But like the she definitely does.
So Theo identifies as queer and dates women, but seems to be more questioning her gender identity. Talk about the role that plays in Cha-Ching.
You know, when I wrote that, I'm someone who kind of is a weird gender, I guess. And so I just wanted to also represent people, like a whole spectrum of queer people in the book. You know, that was really important to me because a lot of times you don't see a whole spectrum of queer people in books, you know. And so I wanted to have this person that kind of reflected my own gender identity, which is, I guess, on the butch. I don't know how it's all what the vocabulary is for it all now, but a butch person. So mostly thinking about travel and just navigating the world as someone who is, you know, a female body but looks, you know, masculine, and what that's like, and all the just little things that come up between getting a haircut and going into rest area bathrooms and stuff. And so that was more really just like, I read this book by Sarah Schulman that I like to talk about a lot because I feel like it's such an important book. It's called The Gentrification of the Mind. And she talks, there's a chapter in there called The Gentrification of Our Literature, where she talks about how writing queer characters is the kiss of death, really, for any kind of published work, you know. And to write an authentically queer character, especially a lesbian character, is especially like publishing is really afraid of that, you know, content. And that was really on my mind when I was working on this, to reflect people who don't necessarily always get reflected in literature. In fact, rarely get represented.
So what are some of the situations that she encounters where, like, gender becomes especially salient?
I think it's like she was worried about traveling across the country when she's driving with Cary Grant. She had a neighbor in San Francisco that was a trans woman who had given her a going away gift of a, she called it the butch bathroom wig, so she could have a wig to wear in rest area bathrooms. And I'm trying to remember if there's other, it's just sort of there always getting hair. There's a barber scene. She's just always, I guess mostly she's in the world waiting for people to, like people, when she would walk into a store, they would say, "Hello, sir." And then, you know, there's a line in the book where she's the timid sir, ma'am, sir, which is like, something that I got. I was once on a plane and a flight attendant came by to ask everyone for drinks. And she said, "Can I get you a drink, sir, ma'am, sir?" She just got caught in this loop, you know, and it was, I mean, it was awful, but also really funny, you know. So after that, I was thinking about the sir, ma'am, sir as like some sort of weird forest floor animal that tiptoes around.
And so you said that you wanted to represent a whole range of queer characters. Can you talk about some of the other characters in the book and how maybe like their gender identifications and sexuality might differ from Theo's?
Sure. There's really three main characters in the book. There's Theo, who is got the gambling addiction and she's trying to turn over a new leaf. And then her friend, Sammy, who Sammy is like another butch, but Sammy lives in Brooklyn, and they had met in jail. They were illegally arrested together, and so she doesn't know her well, but she kind of looks her up when she moves to New York. And Sammy's just like kind of like her fellow butch who's also making not great choices, and she's just kind of constantly trying to figure out what to do with her life. So she's trying to now like go to massage school or something. And then there's Theo's love interest, with just Marisol. Actually, I think is maybe my favorite character in the book. And I wish I have more Marisol. Like, she's someone, when I finished writing the book, I was like, I want to write more about Marisol. So I don't know if that will happen or not. But Marisol is biracial. Her father was a white fag. And her mom is Puerto Rican. And they met as hippies. And then Marisol's dad ended up killing himself, and Marisol's mom's in rehab. Although none of this really enters the book, you know what I mean? But there's a little like history of it, but I had to do a lot of thinking about who she was, you know? And so she's probably someone who could pass in the world as straight, you know? She's a laid off librarian who tries to be a stripper for a single night, and it doesn't really work out, you know, because she lives in an apartment above a strip bar. But she could pass in the world as female and just straight and stuff. And so I think her identity is probably more overt as queer, like when she's with Theo in the world.
And I was going to get to this later, but as long as you're discussing Marisol, I thought she was a really interesting character, too. And I noticed that for like 2/3 of the book, it was mainly through Theo's voice. And then you started getting into Marisol's head, which I thought was a really cool choice. Why did you do that? And how do you think that served the book?
I don't know if it serves the book or it doesn't, but like, I think I knew that I wanted to tell a lot of Marisol's backstory, and I wasn't sure how to do it in such a short period of time. I threw out about over 200 pages of the book. I do that with every novel. I like write 200 extra pages that then end up getting thrown out. But so I had more from Marisol's perspective, but that chapter that is from her perspective is really, I like to read from that on tour. Actually, I read from that last night in Seattle. I just felt like what she was, she's on a lot of Xanax, and I thought it would be more difficult to tell that through Theo's perspective than her own, you know? And I don't know why I actually remember writing that chapter. I don't remember writing all the chapters, but I remember when I was working on that one, and there was just this certain energy that I felt when I was writing it that felt like it was going to be a keeper for a chapter. So, yeah, I love Marisol. I love Marisol. It's funny when, because she's like truly a fictional character, you know, and it's very interesting in that process of creating a character that you feel a little bit attached to, you know, so.
So Theo aspires to higher things like doing art and reading literature, but also often seems to shoot herself in the foot. Why is that? Do you think that she triumphs in the end?
I think the ending is ambiguous, but in a way, with the giant metaphor about addiction, you know, she's going to move, she's going to change her life. That concept of like, oh, if I move to a new town, everything's going to be different. If I just get this job, I get this girlfriend, everything's going to change, you know? So I think her aspirations of making art and reading books that she thinks are part of like the canon, you know, kind of go with that in a way, you know? But she is too wrapped up in her addiction really to focus on anything else, you know? And, at the end, you know, the ending of the book, I really wanted it to be a open-ended book, but definitely there was a hopeful ending, and I intended it with some hopefulness at the end that they might be on to some better paths.
Cha-Ching is set in the early 90s. Would it have been different if it was set today? Why or why not?
I think so. I don't think a person can move to New York or San Francisco today in someone of Theo's background, class background, and with her means, they're just too prohibitively expensive to live in today, I think, as just a regular working class person. Did you read that book, Just Kids, by Patti Smith?
No, I heard about it. My mom read it.
It's really good. But she's describing that kind of New York that's gone now, you know, where all those artists moved to New York and they're living in hotels in the 70s and just getting by, you know. And it's like, it's just all those places are gone, you know. And I guess Portland's one of those places, right? You can come here and be an artist and live in the rain all
year. So they say.
Yeah. I don't know. So I think that's the main difference, really, that was a goal, too. One of the other minor goals for the book was to kind of capture some of those neighborhoods that aren't there anymore. I live in San Francisco now. It's like, I can't believe the gentrification I've seen in the last 5 years. It's like, there's streets that are just unrecognizable.
Something else I noticed about Cha-Ching is, like, today we're all so hyper-connected. You know, I have email, Facebook, all the social networking, you know, cell phones, text messaging, whatever. And it seems like their relationships are pretty different. It seems like Theo kind of like packs up everything and moves without much of a plan and without really like connecting to anyone per se. But then when she gets there, she strikes up kind of immediate relationships, which seem just kind of different. from how people operate in a more like hyper-connected environment.
Yeah, I think it's true. You know, one thing is I'm on this book tour right now, and I did this book tour for the first time in the 97 with Sister Spit Next Generation. And so there's like all these different performers, and someone wrote to me on tour and was like, who'd been on the tour before, and said, I bet tour is really different now that you can watch Netflix on your phone. And I was thinking, you know what? It's true. We never had cell phones the first time around or anything, that constant distraction to Instagram or whatever happens all day long. I don't even know. I don't understand Instagram. I don't get the rush that others do. But anyway, I think there was that time, though, about like that payphone era where you had to wait for someone to call you on a – you had to be in your home. You had to be in a fixed location. Think of like when Theo calls Marisol from a casino payphone, you know, and she's waiting at home when – I think on Christmas Day for Marisol to call. And that idea that you just had to be in this fixed location if you were like crushed out on someone and you were hoping that they would – you know, like those old movies where you stayed home all night and you laid by the phone waiting for it to ring, you know, so – yeah, but when Theo goes to Yonkers, she has to, like, she strikes up a kind of small relationship with the guy who works at the convenience store, Randy, and he's kind of lonely, too, because he works at Yonkers, 7-Eleven or wherever they were, the Quick Stop, that's where that is.
Yeah, I especially notice, you know, she gets to Yonkers and she's not living anywhere.
Right.
So she gives everybody the number of the payphone. Right. You know, that's just something that you wouldn't see today.
No, you wouldn't. You barely see a payphone. Although I just saw a payphone in the weirdest place. I was at Muir Woods, and there was a payphone like right outside of Muir Woods.
Where's that?
It's like a national forest.
Oh, okay.
But it was like so strange that I thought like who? Because most times you just see the payphone ripped out, and it was still there. So I just thought it was really funny that there was still a payphone in Muir Woods that was operable. I picked up the receiver to see if it had a dial tone, and it did.
Well, that's good.
Yeah.
In a pinch?
In a pinch. If you're ever in Muir Woods, there's a payphone.
I was wondering, would you like to read a section of the book?
Sure, I'd love to. All right, I'll read from chapter 15. Theo walked into Bellevue and followed a series of signs, hallways, and elevators until she got to the dental clinic. She signed her name on a clipboard and looked for an open chair in the waiting room filled with sad-looking people sitting in bright orange chairs. The receptionist was behind a thick plastic window with a cartoon mouse hole opening at the bottom, where patients grabbed a blue pen tied to a long string. If Theo had been a Martian sent to Earth, asked to report back about her findings of New York City, she would say it was a place where employed people sit behind clear bulletproof plastic to avoid being shot by impatient people. She took an open seat behind an older white woman with blonde curly hair and a rose tattooed on her wrist. She was probably in her 40s but looked 60 and reminded Theo of someone in a crystal meth ad campaign. She once had seen a billboard with two 30-year-old women side by side, one middle class and one homeless, the homeless woman looking a million years old. In addition to being an addict, the woman also looked like a hooker, the street corner kind, a streetwalker. What an ugly phrase. When Theo sat down, the hooker turned around and gave her a jovial smile. Theo acknowledged her nodding. She didn't feel like talking to anyone and pulled Crime and Punishment out of her coat pocket. She caught a whiff of Marisol's perfume when she opened it. Then, for the 1,000,000th time, she opened it to page 1. On an exceptionally hot evening, early in July. Marisol had been a stripper for a single night, which made her a sex worker. Sex worker had become such a liberal arts college phrase. If Theo could do a billboard series, she'd photograph two women side by side holding Crime and Punishment. One woman would be the Bellevue streetwalker, and the other a recent graduate of Sarah Lawrence College with perfect teeth who'd done phone sex for a summer in order to write her thesis. Underneath would be texts that said, which of these women married an investment banker? Even with her head bent down, Theo could feel the woman in front of her craning her neck and making obvious gestures to see what she was reading, so finally she gave up and held the book cover up so the streetwalker could see it. She wanted to stop thinking streetwalker in case the woman had ESP. She didn't want to hurt her feelings. The woman smiled wide and read the title slowly like a child, Crime and Punishment. That sounds about right. Theo gave her a smile, the same kind she was sure many people had given her before moving past. Is that a book about this place? The woman asked and then laughed wildly, because I've been waiting 2 hours for a root canal, so this sure feels like Crime and Punishment. She raised her pilled-out voice to say 2 hours, as if by doing so she could aim it through the mouse hole opening in the receptionist's window. Just then a police officer walked in and handcuffed a prisoner to an empty chair in front of the room while he spoke to the receptionist. Everyone stared. Now that's some Crime and Punishment, the hooker whispered to Theo, slapping the front of her book like it was a knee. A few people stared. Theo was beginning to like the woman. This is where they take you if they can't fix your teeth at Rikers, the hooker whispered. Theo watched one of the prisoner's pinky fingers twitch after being cuffed. I'm Daisy, she said, extending her hand. Theo said, shaking it.
Cool. Well, that sounded great.
Thank you.
Well, I'm about out of questions, but thanks so much for coming on the show, Allie.
Thank you so much for having me.
Again, this is Jennifer Kemp for Between the Covers, and I was speaking to Allie Liebgott, author of Cha-Ching.
People with mental illness continue to cycle in and out of jails and prisons at unprecedented rates. Mental Health Court is a diversion program designed to keep mentally ill individuals out of the criminal justice system. But how effective is Mental Health Court? Is it linking people with community treatment and keeping them out of jail and prison? On May 20th, Jean Dentinger, program manager of Multnomah County Diversion Court, joins Prison Pipeline, along with Matthew, Chris, and Dale, who share their experiences with Mental Health Court. Join us on Prison Pipeline, May 20th at 6:30 p.m.
KBOO is proud to co-sponsor the Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility's Particles on the Wall, an exhibit of the story of the Hanford Nuclear Reservation and the human environmental tolls of the nuclear age. The exhibit is being held at the EcoTrust Building, 721 Northwest 9th Avenue in Portland. There is a reception on opening night, Friday, May 3rd, from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. that is open to the public. The exhibit will show through June 14th. More information about this exhibit and opening night can be found online at the KBOO Community Radio Events page at kboo.fm.
Tomorrow, Friday, May 3rd, you can join Head, Heart, Hands, Spirit, members of Code Pink PDX and members of Portland WILPF to protest drones. That's tomorrow from noon till 2 in Portland's Pioneer Courthouse Square. Educate and activate against unlawful drone deaths. Meet on the east side of Pioneer Square at Southwest 6th at the milepost marker.
One child grows up to be somebody that just loves to learn. And another child grows up to be somebody you just love to burn. Mom loves the both of them. You see, it's in the blood. It's in the blood. Both kids are good to mom. It's a family affair. It's a family affair. It's a family affair.
Are we really happy here with this lonely game we play? Looking for words to say. Searching but not finding understanding anywhere. Lost in a masquerade.
Well, good morning. This is O.B. Hill with Mirror Image Books, and Black Book Talk is on its way. I'm joined by
Patricia Welch, the library lady. Good day to everybody.
And Emma Jackson Ford, bookwoman. Good morning.
We have a guest today, Mr. Clinton E. Galloway. The book we're going to be discussing is Anatomy of a Hustle. Cable comes to South Central L.A. Yes, Mr. Galloway, are you there?
Yes, I am. Good morning.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. How about yourself?
Oh, we can't complain. It's nice and sunny here in Portland today.
That's a nice change. We both got it today, then.
Okay. Yes. Well, let's get into this. George Benson was saying there's a masquerade going on. It seemed like you were pointing out a similar type of phenomena in your book, Anatomy of a Hustle.
I think those are apt words. You know, they're pretending that one thing is going on, but another's going on. What we're led to believe is the politicians are doing for, you know, black communities is simply not true. They're doing very little, if anything, for it.
Now, you still live in L.A., and tell me a little bit about this book, publishing company, Phoenix Publishing Corporation?
Correct.
Is that yours? Or?
I own part of it. I do own part of that company. And part of the money used to do that was some of the money we received in the settlement from the city. Because we realized when we weren't going to get the access to video medium that publishing was our next avenue. And it still remains an important avenue. And the books are still very important to people. And they need to read.
I like hearing that as a librarian, though we certainly are into the digital age, too. But for the benefit of our viewers who have not gone through the whole cable process, I was living in Detroit when cable came to Detroit, and so I could really relate to a lot of the things that were in this book. Just talk about the process. What are the circumstances that brought you to writing this book?
Well, in 1979, my brother came up, really recognized what cable would become over the future. And it offered an opportunity for the poorest community to have a chance to express itself within itself and to get information that it wasn't getting on broadcast medium. When we came to the city of Los Angeles to do this, no one wanted to build it. No major company in the United States was willing to build it. No one in the black community or in the political community here had even heard of cable. They didn't know what it was about. We came in and said, okay, we'll put up the money that's necessary, which was, at that point, was about $35 million. To do the system. We had access to a lot of doctors. My brother was a doctor. I was in the investment banking industry. And we said, let's put up the money because the community needs it. And it's something that can be very valuable because information is key. And, you know, the being locked out of the technology age basically was the equivalent of being locked out of reading in the 1800s. Mm-hmm. Unless you had access to technology, you can't have access to all the information that goes on in this country. And we don't have it.
So what happened? Just tell us a little bit more about what happened in the process of trying to obtain this license.
So when we went down to City Hall and explained to them what we wanted to do, and they referred us to one of the councilmen there and said, well, you know, he'll help you work through the bureaucratic process because there's a large bureaucratic process down in Los Angeles. It's a big city. And in the second meeting that the councilman's deputy had with my brother, he told my brother that we needed to give them control of our company in order to do business here. And neither my brother nor I were willing to accept that as a, you know, given in terms of doing business, that you had to do that. So they said, well, unless you do this way, we're going to do everything we can to prevent you from getting into the cable industry. So we said, well, you know, go for it and do it the best you can do. We went through the entire process, which took 3 years of, you know, several million dollars of engineering studies and various studies that were necessary for what the city had asked for. We had to prove our ability to finance the system, and we had did that. The city said, well, yes, you have all the money, and then right before they were ready to award the license, they said, no, you don't have the money. They said, well, how can you change that in the middle of the process? They said, well,